Oh, there you are, man.
Hey, I am so excited. We've got an incredible episode, and it really is amazing. It's amazing and weird, but we'll get into it shortly.
Yeah, it's amazing and weird. It's a specialty of ours.
And did you dive deep into the rabbit hole? Because I did. Because all the questions you asked were all that you put in the bullet points for today's guest interview. Are all the same questions I have, too.
Well, there, we're of like minds. Do we reveal who it is yet, or we'll do that in a minute?
We will in a second.
All right, in a second. Well, so what's up, Dave? What's on your mind, man?
You send me these links about Paleo News, and I've usually read them.
Yeah, I know.
But did you know that when we went to the Amazon trip, you probably found this before, there is a fungal parasite that takes control. There's many of them, by the way, that takes controls of animals' brain functions.
Right, the zombie fungus.
So there is a fungus that takes control of an ant's brain.
Right, yeah.
Causes the ant to do several things. One of them is clasps its mandibles onto a blade of grass or leaf. Sometimes it instructs the ant to climb to the top of a blade of grass or branch or leaf. Right? It instructs the ant to clasp its mandible and hold tight. Then the fungus explodes out of the ant's abdomen or brain or thorax, depending on where the fungus is, creates a stalk-like mushroom, and then releases its spores.
Yeah, it takes over the brain. It bursts out of the brain. Oh, it's just horrible. It's like real life invasion of the body snatchers.
The movie Aliens. That's what I'm talking about. So,
all right.
Yeah,
a little chest burster.
Yeah, a chest burster. So here's the two cool things. When we were on the Amazon, someone found a leaf with an ant on it.
I remember that.
And I have a photo of that, which I'll put on this episode website. Well, the reason why I'm talking about this is scientists have just found this event preserved in amber.
No.
Yes.
It's been around forever, huh?
It's a 50-million-year-old amber from the Baltic region, where a lot of amber is from. And when you look at this picture, you could see a mushroom growing out of the ant's abdomen.
Ouch.
And a bunch of other fungal.
Hurt.
Yeah, because it died. It obviously, this is the throes of death. And there's a bunch of other fungal bits in this clear piece of amber as well.
So this has been going on forever, ever and ever. This is in the Eocene then, 50 million years ago.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah,
in amber.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, who knows how long it has gone on. And in that book that we're both reading, Locked in Time. You paleo nerds need to get a hold of this book, Locked in Time by Dean Lomax, because it's an entire book on fossils that represent a moment in time with animals being preserved in action. For example, there's a T-Rex and a Triceratops, classic enemies that died and got preserved fighting each other. There's early fishes and turtles preserved in the act of mating, the last tracks and body of a dying horseshoe crab, plus many, many more that show preservation in what I like to interpret as evidence of a living moment in time. A Wednesday at 3 p.m., life in action, but millions and millions of years ago. It's an awesome book, Locked in Time by Dean Lomax. Totally worth it. He talks about a parasite that affects birds that they found in the famous Sioux tyrannosaur.
That's right. It had it all over its jaw.
So in its jaw are these holes drilled in by this parasite that eats the bone. And it must be a very, very painful condition.
Pretty nasty stuff. I thought I should explain, too. You may have wondered about my croaky voice this morning.
No, you sound very bedroom, Barry White-ish.
I do, don't I? So I just wanted to point out to our listeners that I'm recovering from a cold. And yes, I'm fully vaccinated, but I got a cold. So,
well,
I haven't had a cold in a year and a half, man.
Yeah, well, tum yum soup.
Yeah, yeah, I'm going to try that. But anyways, we're set to call our special guest.
Yeah, they're all special. Every single episode, our guests are special.
And, yeah, they are, Dave. They are, but some are specialer.
And tell me how you first came across Karen Chin.
Karen Chin is our guest today, and I have known of Karen's work forever, really. She's one of the bigger names in paleontology. And she's kind of started her career out with Jack Horner, and we'll hear a little bit about that. She's another one of those kind of accidental paleontologists. She got turned onto it, and then off she went. But she is an expert in?
Yeah, in coprolites.
Coprolites. Some people say coprolites.
Well, you know, show, I just we'll watched, coprolites. I went down the rabbit hole. Everybody says coprolite, not coprolite. So I'm going to stick with that. But
what is it?
Oh, coprolites, it's fossilized feces.
Fossil feces.
Before we call her, I just want to get out all the stupid jokes right now. It's like, don't want to do that in front of her. Like, what was this
about?
Come
on, we don't get to be idiots with
like,
her.
Like, who is the poopetrator, right?
The poopetrator, man. The
Which dinosaur laid this giant turd? Who's the poopetrator, right?
Dave, coprolites happen, man. Coprolites happen. See, there's one. That's a t-shirt. Coprolites happen.
Oh,
get it?
That is a t-shirt.
Okay,
but
I
have to correct you, though.
Coprolites happen.
In your bullets, you said that coprolites are rare.
Coprolites are kind of rare every now and then.
They are very rare in herbivore dinosaurs and not so rare in theropod dinosaurs because theropod dinosaurs, the meat eaters, help mineralize their feces rather than the herbivores they break down.
No. I think it's exactly the opposite, dude.
Well, we'll ask her.
Yeah, no, I think it's the herbivores, the herds of cattle-like creatures are pooping all the time.
They don't fossilize because they're filled with plant material. Whereas, the theropod and the meat eaters, because there's so much calcium and phosphorus in the tissue and in the bone, that helps mineralize the coprolites.
I read that paper completely different, man.
Well, let's call up our guest,
Karen Chin.
And you know what? We'll just go right into it.
And I'm going to ask her about her background, but really, you're denying me the jokes that we can have here, Dave?
No, keep them clever. That's all. Keep them clever. Because you know what? My question at the very end addresses this very topic about jokes and feces.
Oh, okay.
All right.
She's heard them all, I'm sure.
Okay.
All right, call her up.
All right.
Hey, Dave, meet Karen Chin, professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Colorado in Boulder. She's also the curator of paleontology at the University Museum of Natural History, and she is considered one of the world's leading experts in coprolites, if not the leading expert. It's a great honor to meet you finally, Karen. I've heard so much about you. I've known about your work for decades, and meet my buddy Dave.
Hi, Karen.
It's a pleasure to meet you formally, Ray, and to meet you, David, as well. Thank you so much for inviting me to be part of this.
Thank you for being here. We have so many questions about fossil feces, but first I want to ask you, are you a paleo nerd and how did it all begin?
Oh, I'm absolutely a nerd and I'm proud of it.
Yay!
Yay, we like that.
Well, actually, it's interesting, though. When I was growing up, I had a dinosaur book, just like almost every kid. Yeah. And I thought it was really cool. But then I kind of grew out of that phase. And I was interested in everything. I'm interested in plants, animals, funguses, bacteria. And when I started... It was a lark that I actually got into paleontology. I met Jack Horner at the Museum of the Rockies when I was in graduate school working on plant ecology. And I needed work at the time. He offered me a job preparing dinosaur bones.
Wow.
So that's how I got into it. But before that, I thought, you know, it's crazy for people to be interested in fossils. Why would you want to study something that you can never see? Well, when you can walk out the door and you can see everything brilliantly.
Yeah, I've read a few of the bios on you. And yes, as a kid, you liked naming off all the Latin names of living things.
That's right.
So you took a big turn. You got the fossil fever working with Jack Horner. You were cleaning bones.
But what an opportunity of all the paleontologists on the planet. He is like, when was
He's
this? This would have been what? The 80s, 90s?
Yes, this was in the late 80s.
Right.
And it was totally serendipitous. I didn't know that he was such a renowned person at the time. I did talk to our museum director at that time, and he said he had a hotshot paleontologist coming in, but I didn't follow paleontology at the time, so I didn't realize how incredibly fortunate I was.
And you're at the Museum of the Rockies. You end up going out to Egg Mountain, the Two Medicine Formation, and you're collecting stuff, and there were these mysterious blobs, right? That's the big segue?
Well, kind of. So
okay.
When one of the jobs, I had several jobs working for Jack. I cut bones to look at their histology. And I also wrote text for the museum. And as I was looking for things to write about, I ran into some reference that said that fossil feces had been found. And I thought that was the craziest thing. How could you preserve something that's so mushy? So I ran to Jack and I said, hey, you know, isn't this funny? And he said, well, I have found some. And I was absolutely shocked. And I asked him to show me some, and he did. And because I was making thin sections of bone, I asked if I could make a thin section of the coprolite.
Wow.
And so when I did, and I looked through the microscope, I could see plant cells from 75 million years ago. And it blew my mind. And I thought, you know, if we want to try to understand how dinosaurs interacted with other organisms in their ecosystem, this is the way to do it.
Now, was this a coprolite that looked like a, you know, a hot dog or dog feces? Or was it one of those blobs that didn't, that you couldn't tell because like it had little white phosphorus?
Did it resemble a turd? It looked like a turd?
That's what I was trying to ask.
You could say the turd is the word. We could use that term here. So did it look like one?
Actually, not too much. It looked like a really weird rock. And what happened is when Jack was out at Egg Mountain, in the Two Medicine Formation, he found these weird rocks that looked like they had a bunch of plant tissue in it. And it reminded Jack of when he was a child. Well, maybe not a child, a teenager, when he was growing up in Montana, when the circus would come to his small town, he would get a job cleaning up after the elephants. So he rather assumed that all these, since he had found lots of dinosaur bones, he assumed that when you found a bunch of chopped up plant material in a rock, that it was probably a coprolite.
Wow.
Jack is very intuitive in his scientific thinking. But when I began studying them, I still had to lay out the multiple lines of evidence that actually confirmed or supported that these are coprolites.
Let me ask you this. Were you one of the first people to do these thin sections on feces?
Well, that's a good question.
Because you really know you are associated. You are. This is stuck to your reputation, if I could use that word, that you are the person. You are the go-to person for coprolites. I'm wondering if you were the first person to pioneer this. I know that when I read up on the history of coprolites and how we know they are fossil feces, that Mary Anning is credited for having figured out, hey, wait a minute, these strange blobs are probably fossil poop. And then
Well, she found spiral bits in plesiosaurs or ichthyosaurs.
Yeah, ichthyosaurs and the plesiosaurs, and then Buckland ended up getting credit for a lot of
now,
it.
Who's this Buckland guy again? Was he the guy William that Buckland, stole her fire?
Well, he was a well-known scientist back in the Victorian days. But what I'm wondering is, with Karen, that you were doing some pretty revolutionary work looking at these turds, as it were.
Well, that's an interesting thought. I guess I hadn't thought about it because you are right. We've known about what fossil feces are for longer than people have recognized the group of dinosaurs. So people have been studying them for many years, but I think that probably most of the studies were probably morphological.
Like the size and
chemical
shape.
Chemical tests, right.
Yeah.
So I may have been one of the first or one of the first to do
things. Well, that's so cool. But what can a fossil feces
what is the criteria to establish the fact that it is fossil feces? You're about to say
Okay.
Well, that is a really good question because actually studying fossil feces is very challenging because when you find a bone, you can look at the fossil and say, this is a bone. Now I'm going to study, you know, what its shape is and who might have made it. When you find fossil feces, you say, well, this is a shape that looks like a turd, right?
Yeah.
But is it really, or is it just a suspicious
pine cone? What is that? Didn't they think they were pine cones back in the 1800s?
Some fossil feces did resemble pine cones. Yes,
that is a pine cone. No, it's not. It's a yes. I can hear it all now.
So shape is actually what we are all familiar with, and that works if you've got a medium-sized animal, like a dog or maybe up to a lion. You get these cylindrical shapes that match the intestinal, the intestines, the cylindrical tubular shape of intestines. But when you're talking about something the size of a dinosaur, it is deformed either when it comes out or upon impact or trampling. So when I started studying dinosaur coprolites, they don't have a recurring morphology.
Oh.
So I look for things like chopped up inclusions that suggest food, like chopped up bone or chopped up plant.
What it was eating, yeah.
Tissues. I can look at the chemistry because animals that eat other animals, that tends to have a phosphatic composition. But if you're looking at those from herbivores, coprolites from herbivores, there's very little phosphorus in plant tissue. And so that has to have an external source of minerals. So then you're looking at maybe calcium carbonate or
so you're
silica.
Saying that the more minerals, the better it is to fossilize and preserve. Well, Ray and I have a bet.
Right, right. So he thinks he's winning the bet, but let me.
This is why I'm seeing all these strange expressions from you too.
All right. So let me just put this out there. So which type of dinosaur poop fossilizes best and is most common? Is it the herbivores or the meat eaters?
It is definitely meat eaters.
Winner.
My ears are turning red.
Let me tell you why. Because the phosphorus content in muscle tissue and in bone helps mineralize the preservation of the feces.
That's right. There's
one of the reasons.
Right. We it's an autochthonous or internal supply of a mineralizing agent. So even though there were in the history of the earth, there have been far more. Well, let me amend that. At least as long as we've had plant tissues,
yeah.
There are far more herbivores than there are carnivores. Herbivore or coprolites from herbivores are really rare.
Really?
Because they have to be deposited in the right conditions, rapid burial, and an external source of minerals. Whereas coprolites from animals that either are animals or other tissues, they've got that in the tissues already. There, as you say, there's a lot of phosphorus in animal tissues.
Wait, I got a stupid question. Why does some dog poo turn white?
Dave.
You have to compare extant feces to understand fossilized feces.
All right, yeah.
Right?
That is ideal, right? But I don't exactly know about dog poop turning.
It's probably poor diet, crappy food you feed your dog, cheap food.
I think it's some kind of chemical change.
Yeah, yeah.
So I can say that I have gone to a zoo and I have looked at hyena feces, and those were the ones I looked at had probably been deposited within a day or so, and some of those were already white. So in that case, I think that was a high percentage of calcium phosphate from the bone they ingested.
Do they feed at the zoo?
Maybe that's it, Dave. Maybe
it could be calcium phosphate.
More bone content, right? Or more meat or something, you know?
Yeah.
Since a coprolite represents one day in time, all right, an afternoon, or it's Wednesday when that dinosaur squatted, all right, one day that the feces was produced, is it possible that the inference of the diet is a time or famine dependent? I mean, if you find one coprolite And if food was scarce or the normal diet was interrupted, and that's all you found of that suspected individual, is it possible that you're not seeing an accurate representation of the ecology of the environment or what that animal ate?
Absolutely. That is a really good point. If I have a day when I am craving candy and that's all I eat one day, you know, and people looked at my poop 3,000 or 5 million years from now, they would say, oh, all people ate candy. Well, that's wrong. That was just one day. So it's really important. I think coprolites are very informative, but it is optimal if you can examine more than one from a given area.
Right.
So
you
get an
days.
Idea of recurring diets.
Got it.
Yeah. Huh. That's interesting. So it really is completely counterintuitive that you are going to find more of the meat eaters' turds than you are from like the thousands and thousands of triceratops and duckbills. But when you started looking at the thin sections, you saw this plant material, and especially with these duckbills, the Myosaurus, you had some startling discoveries that they were actually, you could begin to see the world through basically these little magic packages from the past. And you began to extrapolate environmental information from this, and you came to kind of a unusual conclusion about what the Myosaurs were eating. What was that?
Right. Well, first of all, I love that you describe them as magic packages, because I do, they do give
That's
you
a
this...
quote from you, actually. I wrote it down. You okay. actually said that.
You also said, yeah, you said feces are bags of bacteria, too. That's another great quote.
Yeah. So, yeah, the little magic packages from the past told you something about the world of the Myosaurs.
Now, Myosaurs are hadrosaurs, correct? And they're the ones from Egg Mountain.
Otherwise,
they laid all the eggs in Egg Mountain.
Two Medicine Formation, otherwise known as duck-billed dinosaurs.
Right.
And they laid many of the eggs in that area. Yes. So these coprolites from that we found in the Two Medicine Formation, first of all, the ones where I actually dug them up so I could estimate their approximate original volume, they were about 6 to 7 liters in volume. So they were sizable. I like to say it's maybe a little bigger than a basketball.
Gotcha.
And they were filled with fragmented wood. Oh, well, I could tell that from looking at thin sections. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. But who eats wood, right? They were probably eating conifer. It was conifer wood. And I thought they were eating conifers like junipers that have little teeny leaves. And in order to eat the leaves, they had to eat a lot of twigs. So that was what we published. That's what we suggested.
Going through the stuff, trying to get the twigs and stuff in the plant. I mean, they're like the berries and things, but yet you found a lot of wood.
It was almost all wood. I did not see any evidence of leaf tissue at all. So that could be a taphonomic problem. You know,
right.
They just weren't preserved. Well, it was about 10 years after I published the first paper. I just began thinking about all of the pieces of wood I'd seen in there. And I had not seen one cylindrical piece of twig, which you'd think if they were eating twigs with leaves pressed against it, they have lots of that in their poop. All of the pieces I found were rectangular. It looked like when you go in the forest and you find a rotting log.
Yeah, wood chips and
Right, exactly. So I began looking at the thin sections a little more carefully, and I could see, based on how the cells were together, that all of the wood cells had, not all of them, many of them had been released, and they were free in the coprolite. And this is very unusual, because wood is held together with lignin. It kind of acts like a glue. So all the cells are rigidly held together, and it takes a lot of, it's unusual to break down lignin, because it's so tough.
Yeah, you're eating
that.
Trees, for God's sake. Yeah.
Right.
And as you said, who eats wood?
Exactly.
Woodpeckers. And
no, termites. They don't. They're getting another
termites
stuff.
Eat wood.
Beavers.
Beetles eat wood. Insects eat wood.
Well, yes, but they have critters in their guts that help break down the wood. Wood, like even though, yes, termites eat wood, they have protease in their gut that can break down the wood. But wood, breakdown of lignin requires oxygen. And you can only do that in a very teeny animal with that has a gut that is not far from oxygen.
I do have an animal that I know of that does eat trees that lives in the Amazon. The armored catfish eat trees. So I've been to the Amazon a number of times.
We got to explain that. What do you mean eat trees? Swim up to a tree and eat it? Come on.
Well, actually, there's the flooded forest in the Amazon. The Amazon goes up 40 feet, goes down 40 feet, and the fish swim into literally through the trees.
So what, they gnaw the bark?
I was there with a number of ichthyologists, and we would chop limbs apart, and lo and behold, there would be catfish in the limbs, basically eating out the tree from the interior. And you could Google wood eating, tree eating catfish from the Amazon. Okay. They're Plecostomus.
Do they create a hole and climb in as they eat through?
They chew their way. These wet logs.
Through the wood, eh?
And the wet logs in the forest, you know, in the rivers will be stuffed with catfish.
Karen, you're going to have to rewrite your paper now.
Well, that is fascinating, and I'm going to look that up. That's really cool to know. But I suspect that they were feeding on rotting wood.
Yeah, it's rotting. It is rotting. Yes, it's mushy wood.
So when some bacteria, but mostly to rot wood, it requires white rot fungi. They can break the bonds of the lignin with cellulose. And when you break the bonds of the lignin with the cellulose, you are increasing the digestibility of wood by probably 20 to 30%.
Hmm.
And this is why farmers in Chile are actually known to cut open rotting logs, and then their cattle go and feed on the rotting wood because they are getting cellulose out of that. So I love this I'm going to have to look that up about the tree-eating catfish, because that's another example of organisms being able to capture the cellulose value in rotted wood.
And what is that? Is that like a carbohydrate? Is that like eating grass?
Right. It is kind of. Right. Right.
So what did you infer from this lignin torn piece of coprolite ingested wood?
Coprolitic.
Well, it showed, okay, that these guys had not been just feeding on twigs. They had been feeding on wood that was already rotted.
I see.
So you say, okay, well, why would they do that? Okay, number one, well, yes, they can get cellulose, which is what herbivores feed on. So they could get an enriched diet that way. But why not just feed on leaves? Why go to the trouble of feeding on rotting wood? Because rotting wood takes a lot longer to regenerate than growing leaves.
Mm-hmm.
So my hypothesis at the time was that they were getting sustenance from the cellulose released from the wood. They were getting sustenance from the fungi, but they were probably getting most of their sustenance from all of the fauna that live in rotting logs.
Insects
and crustaceans. Yes, because
mollusks.
If you are a dinosaur, an herbivorous dinosaur, and you are getting ready to lay your eggs, right? You have to have increased protein to yolk those eggs. So if you're an herbivorous dinosaur, like a 24-foot-long Mayasaura, you're not going to be chasing after mice or jumping after dragonflies. If you need a source of animal protein, you're going to go where there is an aggregation of, where it's a predictable source of where invertebrates are going to be hanging out.
Did you find pieces of crabs and arthropods in that?
Snails and things.
in that wood-lined turd?
Well, in the Two Medicine information, we found no clear evidence of insects. We found evidence for dung beetle burrows, but no clear evidence for insects in the coprolites, but that could have been a taphonomic problem.
Well, wait, define taphonomic problem.
A taphonomic problem is that it just, the evidence for the insects, their bodies did not preserve well.
Right, they didn't preserve well.
So the taphonomy, the taphonomy. So
dead stuff, dead things preserved, taphonomy. Right?
Okay.
Exactly, right. Now, we did find snails. However, most of the snails we found were nearly all intact. So that suggests that the snails were post-depositional visitors to the dung pats.
They were feeding on the poop.
Exactly.
Why did you say mollusks in a rotting log? Is this something submerged in water in a marine environment or freshwater environment?
I was wondering if these are the rotting wood might be in sort of swampy areas where they're, you know, I don't know. I just imagine duckbills. Duckbills have batteries and batteries of these teeth, just thousands of teeth, right? And so they could chew through stuff. But are they kind of along a, you think this is a coastal environment, or what was the environment itself?
Well, the environment of the Two Medicine Formation was semi-arid, at least part of the year. And we can tell that because of the caliche nodules that form, that's calcium carbonate that builds up in the soils. But it builds up when you have enough water to mobilize the calcium ions, but not enough to totally rinse them out.
I never heard of this. Is caliche not, would I find that in the Mojave Desert or in Southern California?
You'd find them wherever there's a high percentage of calcium carbonate in the soils.
From the limestone deposits or from marine deposits.
The mountains that drain down into the Two Medicine Formation have Paleozoic limestones.
Yeah, pre-Laramide orogeny.
Yes, so there's lots of, from, like you said, from limestones from the ocean.
Right.
That when you, if you drop, say, hydrochloric acid on the sediments of the Two Medicine Formation, it will fizz because of all the carbonate there.
Right. Okay, Laramide orogeny is one of my favorite pair of words that I've randomly been repeating all my life for no reason. I don't know why, but I love to say those words, Laramide orogeny. Call it OCD or something, but I've been repeating this for decades after I first read about it in a John McPhee book, Basin and Rage. Now, orogeny means mountain building, and Laramide orogeny was a time period of mountain building in Western North America, which started in the late Cretaceous 70 to 80 million years ago and ended 35 to 55 million years ago. So there. I love saying that, Laramide orogeny, Laramide orogeny. You try it. Sorry.
So to get back to the original question, this was not a really wet environment. There were probably pockets of microenvironments that supported things like snails.
Right.
Because they need a kind of a moist environment. But a lot of it was just not a very wet environment. However, I believe that many of the coprolites at the Two Medicine Formation were preserved because of flooding events. And that's why we often see the snails in there. But getting back to your question about...
Keep us on track, yes.
years later, let's see, that paper was published in 2007 when we were looking at the rotting wood that the dinosaurs had ingested. And years later, some of my colleagues told me about other possible coprolites from the Kaparowitz Formation in southern Utah.
Aha.
About the same age. So we started investigating those, and they were almost identical. They had rotted wood inside. They had dung beetle burrows in them. They had snails in them. But they also had crustacean exoskeleton.
Oh.
The carapace of some kind of crustacean. We don't know what kind. Maybe it was a crab, but we only found the pieces. So we haven't been able to put together a full...
I've seen that image. I've seen the...
Crawdads, probably crawdads that were like...
Could have been crawdads, could have been crabs. But the really cool thing about this find is that we found pieces of crustacean throughout many of the coprolites in the Kaparowitz Formation. And that told us that this was definitely, the crustaceans were definitely eaten. Now, if we had found little pieces of insects, somebody could say, ah, those insects visited after the dung was deposited and they were just smashed in there. But when you're dealing with larger crustaceans, when you have pieces, you know that they were actually eaten. So this was really fun to find because it really supported the idea of herbivorous dinosaurs actively ingesting invertebrates.
Making them omnivores.
Ah, good point, David. Touché.
Making them at least the omnivores part of the year, yeah.
So you published a paper on a tyrannosaur turd, and the turd was the word, and it was a really cool paper, got a lot of attention. What did you find from that tyrannosaur feces?
Well, we've actually published two papers on tyrannosaur turds. One was, the first one was on probable T-Rex poop. Mm-hmm. That was the first one, and that was exciting because that was the first time people had recognized large theropod coprolites. Again, they're just, it was an ugly, weird-looking mass, just a weird-looking rock.
Didn't look like a poop.
Didn't look like a nice cylindrical poop, right. And that was cool. It had bone in it, and that showed that the tyrannosaur apparently ingested a lot of bone as it was eating. The next paper was of a larger turd. The first one we had estimated it, but it was probably broken, that it was probably 2.5 liters in volume. But, can I tell you a funny story about
that? Yeah, well, of course. We love funny stories, especially if they're about fossil feces.
Well, I was trying to find evidence that we could say this was definitely produced by a T-Rex. Or, not. Nah, you can never say
that. No, it's a great claim to fame.
Yeah, T-Rex poop, here. Right. Step right up.
If, you know, with coprolites, you can never say for sure, but you can say the most likely candidate.
Right, okay.
Or, as I like to say, the most likely poopetrator, right?
I love that. Can we do the drum roll, poopetrator?
Wait, there was another one. It was who dung it?
Oh, yeah.
Who dung it? Who dung it? We said we weren't going to go there, Dave, in this, but we had to.
Wait, Ray, those are clever jokes, okay? Not stupid, the dumb puns. Ones.
Yeah. All right. Stupid puns. You put dumb puns again. So anyways, you are there with the poopetrator, and you're proving it's a poopetrator.
We're trying to provide strong evidence that it was produced by T-Rex. And so it was 2.5 liters. So we looked at who are all of the carnivores in that particular formation. It was
what year?
Frenchman Formation. And
Cretaceous.
Yeah, the latest Cretaceous.
So that's Maastrichtian?
Yes. Roughly, 66 million years ago.
Right before the comet.
I did that without looking at anything, by the way.
That's impressive. I'm impressed.
He's getting there.
So what I decided to do is to try and find out, to give me a range, what is the largest poop that a person could produce?
Well, there was that Viking one. Wasn't there a Viking one in the news in the last month? That they found, yes, they found a Viking feces, and they, you guys are looking at me like you haven't heard of this.
What? No, this was not in my news feed.
It was in my news feed, and they called it the biggest, this had to be a huge man to have made this, and it was long, and they were able to, oh, my goodness.
Okay, all right.
I'm going to start right now and just see if I can Google this. The Lloyds Bank coprolite is a large paleofeces desiccated human dung specimen. It was discovered in 1972. So I guess this article is about what was discovered. It's the largest fossilized human turd ever found, came from a Viking.
Okay.
Did they say how large it was?
Yeah, here we go. It's this log is many centuries old, but it's a log with a difference, and it is 8 inches by 2 inches, so 20 centimeters by 5 centimeters.
That's a fair-sized poop.
That's a fair-sized poop there, ours by the gods of Thor.
But I think we're talking to a scientist, and Karen is quickly calculating. I saw she was calculating some numbers there.
Well, so I wanted to assume that people were, you know, an average person could be 200 pounds or something. And there were some other carnivores that lived in the same formation that were 200 pounds or so. So I wanted to see what is the largest poop that a human could make. Mm-hmm. And without having the benefit of that article, I called a coprologist out of the blue, cold call. I just called the office and I said, hello, my name is Karen Chin, and I study dinosaur feces, and I would like to ask the doctor if they can tell us what is the largest amount of feces that a human can produce. And the woman who answered the phone said, okay, well, thank you. I will pass that information to the doctor and see if he will call you back. And I said, thank you. And we hung up, and not 2 minutes later, the phone rings again. And another woman answers and said, was this call for real? And I said, yes, it was. And so they said, okay, they passed the message along, and the doctor was very kind enough to call me back. But it's interesting because he said they're, as a doctor, a coprologist, they're mostly interested in the health of humans. They're not interested in the volume of feces. Right. So he didn't really have
any... So you said
any...
coprologist, but we call him a proctologist, right?
No, proctologist.
Is there a difference?
Very different.
Actually, you know what,
Ray? Proctologist is where the poo comes out of. Okay, I couldn't find a coprologist, somebody who studies feces per se, but I did find coprology, which surprisingly is the unclean in literature or art. That's a new one on me. And of course, scatology is the study of feces. A proctologist now is a surgeon who specializes in diagnosing and treating disorders of the lower digestive tract, which includes the colon, rectum, and anus. Currently, proctologists are referred to as colorectal surgeons. There you go. Sit on that one for a while.
You know, to be honest, I don't exactly remember which kind of doctor I called, except that they were people who looked at
I wonder if you hang out with proctologists.
Well, how about did you estimate a human poo could be just an average about half a liter?
I don't recall if we estimated anything for that particular.
Well, let's get into dinosaurs then.
Let's take it back to the T-Rex turd. So, you found out that the tyrannosaurs are actually chewing and ingesting bone? You know, are they actually digesting? Are they going for the bone, and they're also eating meat, or they're like a hyena, crunching bones and flesh?
I think that they were probably primarily after the meat, but inadvertently they might have, you know, when they weren't delicate eaters.
Right.
And they couldn't chew. And
because
they couldn't,
those little hands couldn't do anything. Right.
Right. So they couldn't break apart the food before they put it in their mouth.
Wow.
So I think
So in other words, if they order a bucket of ribs, they're helpless.
That's right. They would eat the whole thing.
I remember this from another interview. So we try to, you know, do our research before we have our guests on. You talked about one of your most your favorite moments in paleontology or in your career, and that's when you saw a bit of actual muscle tissue from the Cretaceous,
right.
A chunk of meat.
So this was the second paper on a Tyrannosaur coprolite. It was from an older Tyrannosaur that was about 75 million years old, so it wasn't T-Rex.
Okay.
And we were able to say that it was much larger than the Tyrannosaurus coprolite or at least we think it was a Tyrannosaurus coprolite. That was 2.5 liters. This older one was about 7 liters in volume. And as we examined it, I had it under a microscope, and I could see these odd shapes that were kind of wavy, really
fibrolamellar,
striated. Yeah, striated.
Wow.
And I made thin sections of this. I made we did scanning electron microscopy. I spent many sleepless nights. One day I'd wake up, oh, it's plant tissue. The next day, no, it's muscle tissue. The next day, no, it's plant tissue. And I was going back and forth with this. And I enlisted the help of a doctor from Stanford who studies muscle tissues. And he looked at it and he said he didn't think it was anything else. But part of the reason was because one of the thin sections I made serendipitously. I mean, this was a pure shot in the dark. When you make thin sections, you're saying, well, I think I'll cut it here. And you never know what you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
But I happened to get a longitudinal section.
Oh, you cut it lengthwise.
Fiber. Yes. And it showed the striated muscle morphology.
Oh, wow.
And it was, I remember I was a postdoc and I had a microscope at home. I was making thin sections at home and I put it under the microscope and I felt like I was in a movie. I think I started yelling because it was so diagnostic of muscle tissue. And this, you know, wow. I've been struggling with this. It was hard for me to believe that a tyrannosaur 75 million years ago could produce a poop and we could still see muscle tissue or meat.
That is so cool. Yeah. I got chills, you know, as you told that story. Was this, where was that turd from?
That was from Dinosaur Park Provincial in Park. Canada.
Oh, so it was probably like a Displetosaurus or something? No, Albertosaurus.
Yeah, there are several different Tyrannosaurus.
That is so cool. That is so cool, Karen.
So you can't really ascribe a species to a coprolite, but I had an interesting experience. I was in the desert, went to an old mining shack, and a coyote had found a piece of old carpet, curled up, and died. And it looked like it was sleeping. And my son and I went, what? And we looked and it had died, but just outside his anus was his last feces. Because he obviously was sick or something, who knows why he died. And it was obvious that that was one of his last actions before he expired. So has there ever been a fossil found, a fossil dying in the act of defecation? Because that would say, wow, that's the coprolite to this individual.
That's interesting. I'm curious. That's a good question, Dave.
Well, there have been a few cases where people have found an undeposited fecal mass in the gut region.
Okay.
So then, I mean, it has not been deposited yet, but then they can say, yes, this gut residue belongs with this animal.
But it would be so chemically different to something that's been expelled and subjected.
It wouldn't have the right shape.
Right.
But I think it could still be quite similar because in the digestive tract, the feces kind of are stored in the rectum area. So if it's right near the end, it's going to be pretty similar. But that's a very unusual occurrence. That would be, there are these, some people have found these fossils of horseshoe crabs. I'm deviating a little bit. Fossils are challenging to study because it's activity and you can't always say who did the activity.
Mm-hmm.
So, is a coprolite a trace fossil? Is it part of ichnology?
It is. It is indeed.
Oh.
So tracks, burrows, coprolites are all trace fossils. And with tracks, you also do not necessarily know who produced it.
Right.
But in some rare cases, people have found the body of
the horseshoe crab. The little dead horseshoe crab, yeah.
And you can see the trackway leading up to the dead carcass.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that's kind of comparable to finding a kind of an undigested fecal mass in the body of an animal.
Coprolites go way, way back in time. I mean, you can actually find little, I'm just thinking of trilobites and their little trackways, and they're trilobites had to poop too, right?
Oh, wait, wasn't there a trilobite in a coprolite? I thought I saw.
I don't know if that's ever been the case.
It was the cephalon of a trilobite in a coprolite. That almost rhymes.
That sounds like poetry. Oh, wow.
I wouldn't be surprised because, yes, there are coprolites that come from the...
what is the oldest coprolite?
Yeah,
there's some from the Cambrian, but there are probably some from the Precambrian as well. There's not as much evidence that they're coprolites, but I think there are.
You mean like a Dicksonian from the Edacrian would have made a poo?
I wouldn't say who produced it, but I mean little you have things poo. That were eating other organisms in the latest Precambrian, so
wow.
It makes sense that you would find some sure. little fecal things. The evidence is not as strong as some of the Cambrian coprolites, but yeah, I mean we're talking old.
Okay, I want to dive into some of your work. If you were to sum up the body of your work, I came across something I've never heard before, and that's called trophic interactions. Now, I'll just define it, and I'm going to read it here because I've never heard of this before. They affect the distribution and abundance of organisms in fundamental ways because they are interactions of the entire environment of organisms, and the success of populations is largely a function of benefits derived from the acquisition of energy and nutrients and losses derived from predation. So what have you learned about the ecosystem? I guess... would you say that the medicine formation is your forte?
To medicine.
It's one of my favorite projects. It's one of my favorite sites because that's where I started much right. of my research. I wouldn't right. say it's my only
right.
Example.
So I think what I'm asking is there a generalization that you have found from studying, the thousands of specimens of coprolites?
I guess what I would say, if I'm trying to answer what I think you're asking, is that when people think of coprolites, they make funny faces and they think about modern feces, and it's kind of it's a natural repulsive reaction because people are naturally inclined to avoid feces, which is protective on our end because we do not want to get sick from diseases or parasites. But in my mind, feces, they kind of represent, they're a symbol of trophic interactions throughout ecosystems. Who is eating whom? How are different organisms connected to each other in an ecosystem? So when I study coprolites, some of them tell me about diet. Some of them tell us about diagenesis.
Which is?
Oh, sorry. Diagenesis is just change, chemical and biological change as the soft tissue turns into rock. So there's
the change of the fossil, how the fossil right. fossilizes.
Right. Right. Yeah. And some coprolites are so well preserved. You can see soft tissues like the Tyrannosaur muscle tissue we found. You can see diatoms, you can see really cool things, and others have been so altered over time that even bone, you're only seeing ghosts of bone, or you just can't see anything. So we think about how soft fecal material was preserved over time. So it can tell us about the taphonomy or the process of fossilization, it can tell us about diet, but I particularly like the specimens that began to allow us to connect different organisms within an ecosystem. And that wow. is why I am partial. There's a soft spot in my heart for the Two Medicine Formation because we have found these coprolites that tell us that those was likely the myosaur duckbill dinosaurs were feeding on rotting wood. So that you can draw a line to the conifer trees. We can draw a line to the funguses because they rotted the wood. And then after that, we have found dung beetle burrows. So those are dung beetles that capitalized on the feces. And then we can draw a line to the gastropods. They were also dung eaters.
which is called Ray. It's called coprophagy. Wait.
Coprophagy.
Coprophagy is something that eats feces. Coprophagy.
Can we say it? I'm going to say it's a shit eater. There, you can bleep that out. But we managed to go the whole show. Nobody said shit yet, so I just said it again. I'll say it one more time.
And
how come we can say all the other words, Karen? We can't say shit, but you know.
Well, guess what? If we were in Australia, you could.
I am absolutely fascinated, Karen, because really, after talking to you listening to your presentations and reading up in your work, really, that you can extrapolate out from these little magic packages for the past. And I really do look at poop in a different way because it is a direct result of the environment. And I read your paper, and Dave did too. We were looking at your work in the High Arctic and on Devon Island. And how just, and there were just hundreds, if not thousands, of these coprolites, and they called you in. You had an Arctic adventure. But from that, you and your team were able to kind of extrapolate the entire northern environment of this polar, this warm polar sea. And
which was not far from where it is now. Devon Island, you said it was only 10 degrees at the time during the Cretaceous. It was only 10 degrees in latitude off than it is now, which is remarkable, because that indicates the polar regions were not polar, but were incredibly temperate.
Yeah, and the fact that you also extrapolated out that, and here we are, tell us if any of this is wrong, but the environment was a near-shore environment, so there was a lot of nutrients coming in. So I just think that is so cool that you can actually, I don't know, it reminds me of a William Blake poem or something. In a single grain of sand, you can see so much, you know, that from these turds, you have recreated these worlds.
Actually, that's, I like that. Because, you know, I think these feces are a symbol of the dynamic ecosystems we live in. There's, you know, all this biogeochemical cycling going on, and they represent a moment of time saying one organism ate another organism before that those organic materials were recycled back to the environment and moved on to other organisms. So, you know, even though people have the initial repulsive reaction to thinking about feces, I think it just shows how dynamic are the biotic aspects of or the biotic universe. Oh, no. Okay. I'm kidding. It shows us how dynamic life on Earth is.
A couple questions. And since you're at a museum, has there been a great museum exhibit on coprolites? Can I go see any of these magic packages? Can I see that T-Rex turd somewhere on display?
Okay. So a lot of the specimens, I do not know if the T-Rex coprolite is on display, because these specimens are pretty, some of these dinosaur coprolites are pretty rare, and they're scattered in different museums. The T-Rex coprolite is the Royal Saskatchewan Museum. I don't know if that one's on display. It may be. I believe there may be a replica of it there and many at other museums. I know of some exhibits on poop. Modern poop. And I know that some people have created some online exhibits of coprolites, but I do not know off the top of my head of an exhibit that just focuses on coprolites.
We never asked a great question. What is the largest amount of coprolite ever found? I mean, there's that scene
What's
in Jurassic
the
Park.
Ever?
Yeah, well, there's that scene in Jurassic Park where it's 6 feet tall by 8 feet wide. I mean, it is a mound that would come out of a dump truck. Is that even, is that just Hollywood imagined?
I rationalize that as saying the zookeepers in Jurassic Park shoveled it all together before it was carried away by a dump truck, as they do in modern zoos. You're right. It was much too big. A triceratops couldn't even have gotten its rear end over that.
Ah, but think of a giant sauropod and the amount of
Like a Titanosaurus.
Yeah, geez.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, we would love to find a big pile of sauropod poop.
It's never been found, huh?
Smaller pieces that might have come from sauropods, but we don't have an intact sauropod, a bona fide intact sauropod deposit.
But you know, when you come across cow and horse poo, it's so grass-like that it seems to just melt back into the environment.
Right. And that's the problem. Remember, it's not just a mineralogical problem, but just like you said, herbivore poop is just not very cohesive.
Mm, interesting. Well, the deer pellets in my yard sure are.
Right.
But that's another creature. But
Ray,
but
why are those deer pellets, why do they taste so salty? Okay, why don't you ask your question, Ray?
Well, I have one. I sent you a picture of a alleged coprolite, and this, I think it's a shark turd. And there's another guy saying, no, it's a shrimp burrow. In your professional opinion, you must be asked this all the time, is, do you think that's a turd? From the photo I took it.
From the photo I
was... And it's so perfectly shaped, and it's like, you know...
Yeah. From the photo, I would be a bit skeptical, but I don't... You know, the problem with coprolites, they can have so many different manifestations. I've seen many, but there are others that I haven't recognized. So it's possible. The only way to tell that would be to do some more, to do a bunch of analyses.
Slice it apart. So, all right, we'll just say it's an alleged coprolite.
There you go.
Allegedly. But, well, let me ask you this, Karen. If you could time travel, all right? You go back in time. You only get one choice here to go back in time. What epic epoch, what favorite paleo period, what awesome age would you like to go back to? And what would you want to see? Would you want to see that duckbill just pooping away? Or would you, am I leading the witness here?
What would you accidentally want to step in?
Yeah, there.
Okay, yeah. I love the 2 minutes information, but I would go back to try to observe some of the largest sauropods on Earth and see what they were eating and see what their poop looked like.
Awesome. That's it.
Wait a minute, you would assure me safe passage back, right?
Oh, of course.
Well, yeah, that's maybe it's in the small print. Yeah, we can get back, we hope.
So that would be what? When were the largest titanosaurs? Jurassic?
Well, titanosaurs last end of the Cretaceous. They're right up the end there. But the big Jurassic guys in the U.S., but titanosaurs in South America were quite robust in the days.
Ray, can I ask my question?
I think it's time, David.
All right. First of all, this has been just so much fun, Karen.
Oh, it's been a lot of fun for me, too.
I hope we've risen to your occasion. One of my favorite Mark Twain quotes, and I'll paraphrase, is one of life's most overvalued pleasure is sexual intercourse, and one of life's least appreciated pleasures is defecation. So, Mark Twain said that.
Twain said that, okay. Yeah. All right.
When speaking to children or the less mature among us, Karen, how do you overcome the squeamish and embarrassing aspect while discussing feces?
Well, especially with children, I like to tell them, you know, this is natural. Just because we're not doing it out in the open, it's like that children's book. Everybody poops. Mm-hmm. In order to live, we have to eat and we have to poop. So I just try to help the kids remember, because, yes, we have these social
norms
built up against just rejecting the even talking about it sometimes. So I do like to make sure that people just think about it as a natural process.
And it is.
Yeah, it sure is.
Everybody poops, man.
In fact, you know what? I got to go. No, just kidding.
Really? So you've heard every joke in the world. Are any, you know, I've seen the t-shirt coprolites happen. Do you have one of those, by the way? No?
No.
Do you have any coprolite jokes that you'd like to share with us? Or I did a drawing once of coprolite beer.
Oh, yeah.
I think
I might have seen that. Yes.
The best ever, you know. Hey, Karen, thanks so much for joining us and, talking the straight poop with us today. I'm sorry I had to do another one there, but it was really fun. And I look at coprolites in a different way now, thanks to you. I really do.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah, Karen, it's been awesome. And I learned a new word, which is comminution.
Oh, yes.
That is the action of reducing a material to minute particles or fragments.
And it happens in you and me and you. Yes, comminution is important.
Comminution, is that how you form a turd?
No, it's the breaking down of anything. It could be digestion. It could be through weathering. It's just comminution is the reducing material to minute particles. Right. So breaking a rock into sand over time is comminution.
Smashing something into little bits. Okay.
Well, thank you.
No, I want to thank you both very much for inviting me on, you know, because when people think about paleontology, a lot of times they think about the bones or the shells or the leaves, all of which are body fossils, which are so cool. However, sometimes the trace fossils don't get as much press. So I really appreciate your respecting that trace fossils add to our collective body of what we can infer about ancient worlds.
But I like them more because they represent a day. They represent a moment in time.
That's
an
right.
Afternoon.
A moment in time. An afternoon, a Wednesday at 3 o'clock, like that. Yeah.
Yeah. We're just all about sharing that paleo love, Karen. So anyways, Dr. Chin, it has really been so fun. So thank you.
And thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I know. That was great.
I think that was one of our funnest interviews, man. That was a blast. Great guest.
Well, you know why? Because you're dancing on the edge of something we're taught is naughty. And you know, we shouldn't be talking about feces and poo.
Yeah,
and so much of our vernacular is the S word, you know. We say it every day, but we tell children not to. So
We have to bleep it. That word we have to bleep out of the show. We use every other description except the one, which is the bizarre things. Anyways.
And I think what's great is that here we are diving into a subject that normally you just always think of as gross, but it's really an amazing wealth of information, especially in the paleo world. I mean, I was blown away. I loved it.
Yeah, there's so much you can learn from just something as base as a pile of poo, man. But yeah. So I learned that word coprophagy, right? Coprophagy.
What's the
animals that eat.
Oh, like a dung beetle.
Dung. Yeah, right. So do you know about the coprophagic bear incident that happened here in Alaska this last year?
No.
Well, a woman went out to the old outhouse and she sat down. It was the middle of winter, you know, where the bears are supposed to be sleeping. Right. And lo and behold, there was a black bear actually down there eating the poo.
In the dunny
in the outhouse and bit her in the butt.
What?
Yeah.
You liar. Bit her in the butt.
Yeah. Actually, now on further analysis, actually, but they thought maybe they didn't actually bite her. It swatted at her.
Right.
But that's a true story, dude. So I thought, wow, I was going to ask her about that, but I thought I would just tell you.
Well, you know,
Dave.
I have caught, I caught Arthur. May he rest in peace.
Your dog, this is we're talking about.
Dude, I caught Arthur eating the poo from humans, other dogs, coyotes. That's really all I care to mention.
So he was coprophagic himself.
Coprophagic himself, yeah. Now I don't know what, you know, the nutritional, I guess if you're starving.
I don't know why dogs would be doing that, but, you know.
Well, here's a question I'm going to pose to you, Ray, and then we'll wrap it up and say goodbye.
Uh-oh.
So if you were starving and you had to eat your dead relative, your dead in a plane crash.
No.
Or become coprophagic.
No.
Pick one, please.
Cannibalism or coprophagic.
Eat the relative or eat your relative's turd. Which would you do?
Oh, man.
Let's leave it there.
Oh,
and end
now
this,
I'm tortured by that
crazy
thought.
Crazy episode. It
may
was
we
great.
Never get to that point in our lives, sir. Yes.
Yeah.
So, but on that bleak note, Really, a very fun episode. And man, she is cool. I want to go hang with Karen. I want to go out in the field with her. I want to, she was just a lot of fun.
And another great episode of Paleo Nerds. If you liked what you heard, please let us know on Facebook, on Instagram, on our website, paleonerds.com. We'd love to hear your suggestions of topics and guests. And maybe we'll do a contest and you can win one of our Paleo Nerds t-shirts.
That's right. You could do that. All right.
And of course, are you, Ray? Are you a Paleo Nerd?
David, why do you have to ask me that repeatedly every show? You know it, sir. You know that I was born a Paleo Nerd.
Me too.
Still am one, man.
All right, you porophagic dog, man. I will talk to you in the future.
In the future. Over now.
Later. Bye.
Thanks for being a Paleo Nerd. Help us spread the word of science. Rate us on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can even email your questions and comments to nerds@paleonerds.com. Did you know each episode is paired with pictures and links? Check out paleonerds.com for photographic evidence that everyone here has been a Paleo Nerd for a long, long time.